This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Texas has 115 prisons. Six of them are in Huntsville. The Texas Prison Museum in Huntsville holds Old Sparky, the electric chair built by prisoners, incidentally, that shocked 361 prisoners to death from 1924 to 64. Now, of course, they die by lethal injection.
Huntsville's main street is an unimposing place. It's Texas's version of quaint small-town America. Yet a quarter of this city's population is made up of convicted criminals.
Huntsville, Texas, is a prison town through and through.
The Texas State Penitentiary at Huntsville, also sometimes known as the Huntsville Unit.
Death row inmates are brought to this unit, where they spend their final hours.
While the prisoner eats his final meal, the men and women who will witness the execution begin to arrive at the prison.
The role of the witnesses by law is to confirm that an individual was actually executed. People volunteer to do this.
One such person is reporter Michael Grochek. He retired, sort of, from the Associated Press on July 31st after nearly 46 years in journalism and after more than 400 trips to the Huntsville unit.
So you climb these steps, go through a series of electronic doors. You walk through a small courtyard and you reach the death chamber and you walk into the viewing area, the witness area. It's a narrow rectangular room. If you stood in the center of it and extended your arms, you could probably touch each wall. You stand and you look through jail bars that are encased in plexiglass. There's a gurney that is bolted to the floor. The warden stands at the inmate's head. There's a chaplain that stands at the inmate's feet. You can hear what he or she says and whatever sounds they make as the drugs take effect. When we're all assembled, a prison official will open a door and tell the warden, you may proceed.
Is there an execution that stuck with you long after the fact?
I remember walking in there and the inmate Robert Black said to me, "Hi, Mike, how you doing?" I didn't know how to react. I mean, you can't get caught up in the emotion of the moment. You also have to be aware of your environment. And let's say, for instance, I'm in there among the witnesses who lost a loved one because of what this inmate did. You don't want to show any expressions of, gee, I like this person. All these things are going through your mind as someone says, "Hi, Mike, how are you doing?" If I could have a do-over, there was one that I would change. There was an inmate by the name of Raymond Carl Kinneman. He tried to wriggle out of the restraints. And the chaplain usually rests his hand on the inmate's leg as a form of comfort. And as Kinneman is struggling to get out of the restraints, I wrote that the chaplain was holding his leg with his hand. So when the story got published and people on death row were reading the story, they perceived that as the chaplain assisting in the death of their friend. And the chaplain was threatened and he had to be replaced and moved elsewhere. I cost him his job there. If I'd have said that the chaplain was resting his hand on the inmate's leg at the time, that would have been certainly better than saying he was holding the inmate's leg. And if I could change that, I would.
Do you have to mentally prepare yourself differently?
No, I don't think so. No special kind of preparation or mindset, at least not for me. As a reporter, you go to a lot of situations where you have no clue what's going to happen and you have to be, aware of what might happen. I've done a lot of sports stories where somebody makes a last second shot or makes a basket or scores a touchdown or something. That's actually good preparation for dealing with news in the real world. And as an AP reporter, you're just exposed to this all the time.
The possibility of something unanticipated happening has a whole different quality from the sports analogy that you just offered. Have you never found yourself emotionally invested in the process with a given person on death row?
Now, I've gotten to know a number of these people quite well. You cannot get emotionally invested. You just can't, because if you do, then you begin losing objectivity. And you also can't forget why they are in the situation they are.
If they did it. I mean, there has been so much talk about people on death row not belonging there and later exonerated by DNA or eyewitness testimony.
And I will point that out in stories if that is necessary. But in Texas, it has not been determined that an innocent person has been put to death. I feel pretty comfortable saying that I have not seen anyone who has been found innocent after the fact put to death.
Even though you're retiring, you're not entirely laying down your pen.
I don't think I just want to totally divorce myself from being a reporter or a writer. I do like what I've done. I will not do the daily kind of grind. That's part of the reason why you get out of this. But at the same time, I can go in there and cover that story for that day and then leave and wait for the next one.
Is it simply because they happen rarely enough and you're so experienced in covering them? Or are you drawn to them?
I don't know that I'm drawn to them. It's something that I've grown to do. I'm not some groupie. I don't walk around with a cloud over my head. I'm not the Grim Reaper. It's news, and I like covering news. I'm not a robot. I do have sensitivities, but I leave them at the door when I'm covering a story.
Has covering it changed the way you think about the death penalty?
I frankly don't discuss that. I don't know if I'm for or against it. I don't know. I mean, I've talked to all kinds of people on both sides, and it's a conundrum. And for me, professionally, it is so much easier to just go right down the center and explain the sides and leave it at that.
You know, it doesn't sound like you would approach this any differently from a traffic accident.
Depends on the traffic accident, Brooke. These are important stories. I try not to over-dramatize them. And if people decide they want a more hyped version of the story, they can look elsewhere and try to find it from there.
Yeah, and I know that's what you think that I'm saying. But what I'm really saying is that if there isn't a particular gravity to what's going on here, why does it need to be covered at all unless it goes wrong?
You know, it's kind of like the space shuttle. People just take it for granted until it blows up. And that's kind of the premise, I think, of your question, that, well, just because the rockets are being launched, that we shouldn't care about that unless it blows up. A death penalty is very similar.
If you cover it that way, there are people opposed to the death penalty that say it should be public viewing because we ought to see what the government is doing in our name.
I've had inmates tell me that they ought to do it on the 50-yard line on Sundays. If that's the way they did it, then we'd be there to cover it as well.
What do you think the impact would be if these were publicly viewable in real time?
I think they would be exploited horribly. But if people are looking for shock value, they're not going to get it. The way the drugs work is the inmate may say that he can taste it or that he can smell it or that it's hot or that it's cold, and he'll take a few deep breaths, and he'll gasp a little bit. Then he begins to snore, usually, and then there's no further movement. And this all takes place within less than a minute, and in some cases, less than 30 seconds. I've had other reporters tell me, after seeing it for their first time, that, gee, that was anticlimactic. And it really is.
After covering 429 of them, is it boring?
No, it can't be boring. No. There's a certain routine to it, and I hesitate calling it routine because I don't think it should be routine when the state takes anyone's life. So let's say there's a certain sameness to them, but no, it's not boring.
you're seeing pretty much the same thing over and over and over again.
It's news. It's what I do. And if I get bored by it, then you need to have somebody else go in there and do it.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Grachik is a recently retired AP reporter still on the job.
That's it for this week's show on the media. It's produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi. And this week, we say goodbye to our wonderful intern, Meg Harney, whose audio editing ear is exceeded only by her enthusiasm.
Bye, Meg.
Bye, Meg. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.